Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 78, Return of the Exiles. Last time, we left off with the death of Constantine the Great on May 22nd, 337 AD. In this episode, we will see how the transition of power affects both the empire and the church. The 19-year-old Caesar Constantius had raced from Antioch to Nicomedia, but by the time he arrived, his father was already dead. Surrounded by the chief officers of the court and the army, the Caesar immediately took charge of the situation. The Augustus's body was placed in a golden coffin draped in purple and escorted back to Constantinople by military guard. The emperor's body was then dressed in full regalia and placed on a high pedestal in the great hall of the imperial palace. Lying in state, the deceased Constantine was honored by the army, the senate, and the people over an extended number of days, as the empire went into ritual mourning. Constantius then led the procession to the mausoleum of the Church of the Holy Apostles. As per the late emperor's will, his body was laid to rest in an ornate porphyry sarcophagus alongside the cenotaphs of the 12 apostles, symbolizing him as the 13th apostle. The Christian clergy conducted the funeral service, and prayers for Constantine's soul were uttered aloud by the assembled faithful. The death of the emperor left the empire with a very serious problem, however. At the time of his death, Constantine shared authority with his three sons and nephew. However, none of these Caesars had been invested with the higher rank of Augustus. Presumably, Constantine had intended to promote his two oldest boys, but for whatever reason, he failed to do so before his passing. This meant that, legally at least, Constantine was still considered the official head of state, even after his death. Both Eusebius of Caesarea and administrative documents from Egypt testify to this unprecedented state of affairs. Unfortunately, only the senior Augustus could constitutionally appoint and promote members of the Imperial College. The Roman Empire was now, technically, in a state of interregnum. The lack of a sitting Augustus wasn't the only dark cloud on the horizon. Trouble began to brew on the frontiers. On the Danube, the Sarmatians revolted, and the reconquered Dacian province was subsequently lost. In the east, the planned invasion of Mesopotamia had been stalled by Constantine's death. The Persians took advantage of the situation by besieging the fortress city of Nisibis, while their allies in Armenia expelled the pro-Roman king. Probably in response to all this, the legions gathered in Syria appear to have briefly mutinied. Within the empire, warning signs were also visible. Almost as soon as his father was dead, Constantius II dismissed his Praetorian prefect, the friend of Athanasius, Flavius of Lavius. Furthermore, in the preceding couple of years, Constantine's sons had refused to mint gold and silver coins in their capitals, acknowledging their cousin Dalmatius as their colleague. It seems the sons of Constantine did not want to share power with anyone but themselves. The rift between the two sides of the imperial dynasty appears to have quickly manifested itself. Our sources hint at some sort of disagreement over the division of the empire, which occurred in Constantinople in the days following the imperial funeral. The dispute was primarily between Constantius II and his uncle and father-in-law, the patrician Julius Constantius. Disregarding his father's succession plan, Constantius II resolved to secure power for both himself and his brothers. In the summer of 337, a dynastic bloodbath took place in New Rome, an event known to history as the Massacre of the Princes. Though our sources for this event are extremely patchy, a likely reconstruction is as follows. Elements of the army were induced, perhaps through rumors that the Augustus had been poisoned to death by his brothers, to declare they would have no rulers except the three sons of the great Constantine. Without trial, nearly all members of the imperial family were killed by the soldiers, their property confiscated, and their memories damned. Julius Constantius was the first to go. His oldest son was also slain, and the marriage of his daughter to Constantius II ended. His older brother Dalmatius the Censor was also killed, as were his two sons, the Caesar Dalmatius and King Hannibalianus. Alongside them were also four additional cousins and a number of nobles connected to the two sons of Theodora. Even the retired Oblavius was put to death, allegedly for plotting usurpation. Only three male members of the dynasty survived, all of them young boys. Julius Nepotianus, the son of Constantine the Great's half-sister Eutropia, was one of them, though his father was possibly among the victims of the purge. The other survivors were the two remaining sons of Julius Constantius, Gallus, the son of Julius Constantius's first wife Galla, and the younger Julian, the son of Basilina, daughter of Julius Julianus, and relative of Eusebius of Nicomedia. Gallus was reportedly deemed too sickly to be a threat, and Julian too young. Julian's survival may also have owed something to the intervention of Christian bishops, specifically a Syrian bishop named Mark of Arethusa, and the boy's maternal relative, Eusebius of Nicomedia. After the massacre, Julian was sent to live in Nicomedia with his grandmother and Eusebius. Gallus was either sent with him or sent to Ephesus. Eutropia and her son, meanwhile, eventually settled in Rome. As many of you know, all these boys will one day don the purple. Constantius communicated these events to his brothers in the West, and they duly followed him in damning the memory of their slain relatives. The only possible display of remorse from any of the brothers came from the oldest. In a show of dynastic unity, Constantine II issued a series of coins honoring both his grandmother Helena as well as Theodora. With their two uncles and most of their male cousins now eliminated, the brothers planned to meet in Pannonia, where they would hash out their new power-sharing agreement. Around this time, another major event took place for which the details are also sketchy. An imperial decision in the name of the three brothers was issued, which declared that the various Eastern clerics who had been exiled by their late father would be allowed to return home. Letters were dispatched from the imperial courts in the West to the affected churches announcing this development. There is considerable debate over whether or not this enactment merely allowed the exiles to return, or if it also allowed them to reoccupy their sees. If the latter, then this effectively meant that, in most cases, imperial fiat was overturning the decisions of church councils, councils Constantine the Great had accepted and enforced. If so, then this would constitute a major disconnect between the imperial and ecclesiastical authorities. Unfortunately, the only exiled cleric whose circumstances of restoration we know anything about in detail is one who was not deposed by a church council that Constantine had recognized, Athanasius. Since his banishment in 335, the Bishop of Alexandria had resided at the Gallic capital of Trier. Over the past year and a half, he had befriended both the Caesar, Constantine II, and the local bishop, Maximinus. On June 17th, the younger Constantine issued a letter to the Church of Alexandria announcing Athanasius's return. The Caesar declared that his father had only sent Athanasius to Gaul for his safety, to prevent him from being physically attacked by his ecclesiastical enemies in the East. The late Augustus had always intended to restore Athanasius to Alexandria, and so now his son was faithfully fulfilling his father's will. Whatever the truth of these claims, Athanasius and many other exiled bishops were soon on their way back home. As we shall see, whether or not these other bishops were officially allowed to retake their sees, they clearly attempted to do so. Athanasius accompanied Constantine II on his way to the imperial summit in Pannonia. At some point, he went on ahead to the Danube frontier city of Viminacium. There, the bishop had his first imperial audience with his new sovereign, the Caesar of the East, Constantius II. After purging his relatives, Constantius had been occupied with a campaign against the rebellious Sarmatians before he began making his way to Pannonia. Though we know almost nothing about the audience at Viminacium, Constantius did allow Athanasius to return to Alexandria. Such an audience suggests that the return of the exiles was the initiative of the Western courts, and that Constantius had perhaps only reluctantly agreed to it. It is also possible that, before his dismissal and execution, Athanasius's friend, the prefect Oblavius, had used his position to influence the young Constantius to allow the Alexandrian to return. Whether or not the other exiles had similar audiences, we don't know. In any case, Constantius had far more pressing matters to attend to. By late August, all three Caesars had arrived for the summit in Pannonia, most likely in the regional capital of Sirmium. Constantine II, as the oldest brother and longest-serving Caesar, was acknowledged as the new senior emperor. Thus, he technically possessed the same formal authority over an officially united empire that his father and Diocletian had wielded. In reality, though, his de facto authority remained limited to his existing territories of Gaul, Spain, and Britain. If it had not been already, the Praetorian Prefecture of North Africa was dissolved, and its territory was incorporated into the domains of the youngest brother, the teenage Constans. The territory of the deceased Caesar Dalmatius was divided, with Constans receiving the diocese of Moesia, and Constantius receiving the diocese of Thrace, including Constantinople. With everything agreed upon, the brothers were jointly acclaimed Augusti by the legions on September 9th. After 111 days, the interregnum was finally over. With that, the brothers left to govern their respective pieces of the empire. Constantine returned to Gaul, Constans remained in the Balkans, and Constantius headed back to Antioch to deal with the Persian War. While the sons of Constantine were haggling it out, Athanasius and the other exiles were reoccupying their churches, or at least attempting to. The imperial decision to restore the exiled bishops led to violent clashes between Christians in the affected cities, particularly those cities which had had a new bishop consecrated in place of the returning exile. Rioting and popular violence between rival Christian factions supporting rival episcopal claimants has been a repeated theme in our narrative of the 4th century. We first encountered it during the aftermath of the Great Persecution in the cities of Rome and Carthage. Unfortunately, this trend is not going to go away. Therefore, I think we should take some time to properly contextualize this violence so we can understand it. Riots in the cities of the ancient world were, of course, nothing new. In Alexandria, for instance, rioting was practically a civic tradition. However, the reforms of Diocletian appear to have exacerbated this problem. The emperors had had to double the size of the Roman military to recover from the crisis of the 3rd century, drawing manpower away from the provinces and towards the frontiers and mobile field armies. In addition, the military command and civil administration had been almost completely separated. Provincial governors no longer commanded the local armies. That role fell to the various regional dukes, counts, and masters of the infantry and cavalry. This reform had been done in part to offset the threat of usurpation, by preventing any one official from having access to the resources needed to attempt a successful coup. All this left the local city authorities with a reduced number of soldiers to maintain order with. When riots did break out in the cities, then, there were basically three possible outcomes. In the best case scenario, the riot was spawned enough that it could either be easily dispersed or quickly burned itself out. In the worst case scenario, the violence escalated to engulf most of the city. Often these large-scale riots spiraled beyond whatever the original cause was, as other citizens and gangs joined in the looting and street fighting. If the violence reached this scale, then additional troops would need to be called in to reinforce the local authorities, and even the emperor himself might become involved. We saw this play out in Antioch back in 327 during the violence which followed the exile of Bishop Eustathius. In most cases, though, the third possible outcome, what the local authorities did to intimidate the masses and restore order was to arrest some token troublemakers. Sometimes these would be publicly tried and executed, but usually they would be ritually humiliated in the city forum or amphitheater. With respect to our story, ecclesiastical politics added a new dimension to these combustible situations. As we've discussed numerous times before, Constantine granted Catholic bishops exemptions, privileges, and resources as part of his patronage of the church and his subsidies of Christian charity. This was especially done with the metropolitans. This made sense, as they were the bishops of the provincial capitals. Whenever the emperor distributed laws or letters to the provinces, he didn't issue a copy to every single town and village, but rather communicated through the provincial administration. Such was the case with the metropolitan bishop, the ecclesiastical counterpart to the imperial governor. Whoever then was recognized as the Catholic metropolitan of the province, that man's clergy were now exempted from serving as decurions on local city councils and the onerous taxes associated with them. He also received imperial largesse, which was used, among other things, to pay for church buildings and provide alms like clothing and food for the poor, widows, and virgins. The final piece of this was possession of the church buildings. Only the lawful bishop and his congregation were legally entitled to possession of the churches. Thus, the local Christian population had a huge stake in who sat upon the episcopal throne. If their bishop was suddenly deposed and replaced by someone whom they regarded as a heretic, they would naturally no longer be in communion with him, and so would be denied access to all the exemptions, subsidies, and houses of worship. It is perhaps no surprise, then, that many urban Christian populations violently resisted the imposition of a new bishop. Of course, this wasn't the case in every city in the empire. Many rank-and-file Christians simply accepted their new bishop and went about their daily lives as usual. Nevertheless, many others had close client-patron-type relationships with their bishops, and were concerned to be in communion with an Orthodox pastor. Meanwhile, if the new bishop had supporters in the city, they would naturally want to do all they could to ensure their man possessed both the office and its benefits. Where they often got the opportunity was in regards to the church buildings. The imperial authorities enforcing the installation of the new bishop were tasked with handing over the churches to his followers. However, the ousted bishop's supporters often resisted this by occupying the churches and refusing to vacate and hand them over. Sometimes the imperial authorities would attempt to bribe, cajole, or threaten the squatters to leave, but often this failed or wasn't attempted. Imperial troops would then need to forcibly confiscate the churches and hand them over to their new owners. Yet, because the local magistrates only had a limited number of troops under their command, they often enlisted the assistance of some local muscle in the form of mobs and even gangs. We saw this play out in Carthage back in 317, when Constantine ordered that the churches be handed over to the followers of Caecilian. To dispossess the Donatists of the churches, the imperial officials sent in a mob alongside their regular soldiers, which resulted in much violence and bloodshed. Okay, now that we have an understanding of the urban violence at play, let's resume the narrative. Athanasius took the long overland route on his way back to Egypt. At every turn, he made sure to spread his version of recent events and expanded his network of allies and sympathizers. He also participated in restoring many of his fellow exiles. Among those whom he may have helped first was Lucius, Bishop of Adrianople in Thrace. Lucius, you may recall, was also brought down by the Eusebians. His predecessor had been an ally of Eustathius of Antioch. Lucius's restoration was naturally met with conflict. He was later accused of taking the Eucharistic bread consecrated by his replacement and throwing it to the dogs. It is not clear what the full story behind this is, though. Our information from most of the incidents which followed the restoration of the exiles in 337 comes from a letter issued by a decidedly pro-Eusebian council some years later. We can gauge the level of potential distortion in this letter by its description of the Ischyrus incident. According to this letter, Athanasius, with his very own hands, smashed Ischyrus's chalice, broke his altar, overturned his episcopal throne, and burnt down his basilica. In other words, the most exaggerated and fanciful version of the Ischyrus story yet. Athanasius's next stop before leaving Europe for Asia was Constantinople. The Church of New Rome was currently engaged in an episcopal succession dispute. The 98-year-old Alexander, the man who had almost been forced to give Arius communion the previous year, had recently died. Alexander left a testimony where he compared two potential candidates to succeed him, the young presbyter Paul and the older deacon Macedonius. In the document, Alexander expressed his preference for Paul, probably in part for theological reasons. Paul was supported by the anti-Arian Nicene-oriented wing of the congregation, while Macedonius was supported by those sympathetic to Arianism and the Eusebians. Paul was soon elected, but his consecration in the Church of Holy Peace was fraught. Canon 4 of the Council of Nicaea required at least three bishops from the same province to perform the ordination, the written consent of all the province's remaining bishops, and the approval of the metropolitan. Unfortunately, getting the approval of the metropolitan was not going to happen. See, even though Byzantium had been refounded as Constantinople, the ecclesiastical status of the city had remained unchanged. The bishops of Constantinople were still just ordinary diocesan bishops, subordinate to the metropolitan of the province of Europe, the Bishop of Heraclea Perinthus. As you know, the current bishop of Heraclea Perinthus was the staunchly Eusebian Theodore. Nevertheless, three bishops were found to ordain Paul. Athanasius may actually have been one of them, something which would have furthered the uncanonical nature of Paul's consecration. Whether Athanasius was involved in ordaining Paul or not, the Alexandrian made sure to forge ties with him and his supporters. The two had not initially been favorable toward one another. Paul had represented Alexander at the Council of Tyre, where he had signed on to the deposition of Athanasius. Nevertheless, both men realized their shared theological and political sympathies, and so became allies. Paul was soon accused of something, however, by his local opponents, presumably the uncanonical nature of his appointment. Macedonius, however, the supposed leader of the opposition, defended his new bishop. Paul made the prudent decision to conciliate his rival by elevating Macedonius to the presbytery. With that, Athanasius crossed the Bosporus into Asia. As Athanasius made his way across Anatolia, the next major returning exile he encountered was Marcellus of Ancyra. Marcellus had spent his exile in Illyricum, and so was already back when Athanasius passed through. During his return journey, Marcellus had also engaged in social networking with the bishops of the Balkans, spreading his version of events. Marcellus's return to Ankara had been met with considerable violence. His replacement, Basil, also had a strong local following. Violence broke out between the factions as Marcellus's congregation attempted to reoccupy the churches. In the ensuing commotion, houses were burned. The local authorities responded by rounding up many clergymen and virgins. The presbyters attempted to protect themselves by suspending around their necks pyxes, small boxes containing the consecrated Eucharistic bread. But the imperial authorities showed no regard for the Lord's body, and promptly stripped the presbyters and dragged them to the forum. Consecrated virgins were also brought to the forum and had their veils violently ripped off in front of the populace. When Athanasius arrived in Ankara, he and Marcellus quickly became close allies and pooled their networks of supporters together. Marcellus appears to have prepared the groundwork with the bishops in the Balkans and Anatolia, and Athanasius was able to build on this. After conferring with Marcellus, Athanasius continued his journey through Anatolia and then proceeded south down the Levant, where he made sure to strengthen his ties with the many other Christian communities disaffected by the Eusebian ascendancy. Among these was Asclepius of Gaza in Palestine, a friend of both Eustathius of Antioch and Paul of Constantinople, who seems to have followed the former into exile back in the late 320s. Asclepius's return had also been opposed by his rival, one Quintianus. Riots had followed and a church altar was broken. Athanasius had originally accepted Asclepius's deposition a decade earlier. However, as with Paul of Constantinople, both men agreed to put their earlier differences aside in the interest of forming an alliance against the Eusebians. With Lucius, Paul, Marcellus, and Asclepius, the Bishop of Alexandria was building a new alliance to counteract the Eusebians, just as his spiritual father and predecessor had done before him. Athanasius finally re-entered Alexandria on November 23rd, after 2 years away from his church, thus bringing an end to Athanasius's first exile. Yes, you heard that right. First exile. As many of you know, Athanasius will be removed from his church a number of times throughout the course of his life. How many times do you suppose Athanasius will be exiled in all? Twice? Three times, maybe? Athanasius will be exiled from his see a total of 5 times. Keep track of which exiles of Athanasius's we've covered. They are a good indicator of how far along we are in the story of the Arian controversy. Athanasius's return was largely met with much rejoicing as cheering crowds greeted him. Most of the city's Christians were fervently loyal to Athanasius. The exceptions to this were, of course, the Miletians and the small but active Arian community. The Arians in particular reacted violently against Athanasius's return by inciting seditions and conspiring against him. New complaints were soon being made against the Bishop of Alexandria. All the disruption and conflict caused by the return of the exiles did not go unnoticed. Next episode, we will see how the Eusebians quickly regroup to undo all the gains made by the newly forged pro-Athanasian alliance. Their first target? The recently ordained Bishop of Constantinople, Paul.